I wish that I didn't feel like I needed it each day just to survive kids, family, work.
And it's only when people have the awareness and the understanding they can make changes.
There's lots of tools and learning over many, many, many decades. And I think that's the thing in general with ADHD is that there are absolutely ways to become less distracted, to become less hedonistic.
It's raising that awareness of there is another path, there's another path, and this is what it looks like. And this is what it's about. Hi, Rory. Thank you for coming to Therapize.
Thank you for having me.
And are you excited to be here?
100%. I'm a massive advocate for therapy in general. So if this can be any step forward in my journey of therapy, then I welcome it. And if we can do that publicly and inspire a few people to go on that journey too, then amazing.
You may not know what you've got yourself into, but we'll get into it now.
I'm happy to dig as deep as you like.
So, Rory, what is it that people know you as? Because it'll be interesting just to give the audience a perspective of that, and then we can deep dive from there.
Well, if you're a family member of mine, then you know me as a loving, charismatic, pretty crazy, full-giving human being. If you're a friend of mine, then you'll probably know me as a hedonistic, absolutely insane, party starter, fire starter, with or without the alcohol, brought us all together, socializer, first man in, last man out. If you are a friend of mine close nearby today, then you probably know me as somebody who trains a lot and helps people in general. And then if you know me from outside of the world of that, out in the public field, then you probably know me from helping people change their relationship with alcohol, which I've spent almost the last decade devoting my life to try and help the world drink a little bit less alcohol. And looking at it from kind of a completely different angle from where most people are at, which is how I like to look at things in general, and inspire people to see all the advantages and the benefits, all the positives of changing their relationship with alcohol.
And thank you for that. I know sometimes when I ask a question like that to someone who has a diagnosis of ADHD, they're like, where do you want me to start? So you took that question and you organized it really, really well.
It's a miracle when I can get through a full thing with a beginning, a middle and an end. It is a miracle. So if we continue down that and we don't end up down 16 different random pathways, and I have to pause you a couple of times and say, where was I again? And what was the question?
Do you feel like that's something that you have learned to do, is the start, the middle and the end? Otherwise, you end up down these different rabbit holes.
I think so. I think, lots and lots and lots of video practice, podcast practice. I've run my own podcast for years, interviewed, hundreds and hundreds of people, over a million downloads. And so that's a lot of practice, plus producing lots of Facebook Lives and things like that. I kind of worked quite hard on the speaking thing for a while, and I was the whatever it's called. It's not a prime minister. I definitely wasn't that. It's like the head honcho, the director of Toastmasters out here in Mallorca. And Toastmasters is a great organization that you can turn up to. It's basically free, and it will help you organize your speaking and create structure around speaking and all of that kind of stuff. I think there's lots of tools and learning over many, many, many decades. And I think that's the thing in general with ADHD is that, there are absolutely ways to become less distracted, to become less hedonistic, to become less self-destructive, to become less unfocused. We can work on these things. We can improve them.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I don't know if I mentioned this to you. I also had a diagnosis of ADHD when I was an adult. So when I was at university studying my PhD, I was diagnosed with ADHD, and it's only then I was able to understand this is why my brain does this, and then to learn ways. So often people will think, but I have ADHD, I can't do this and I can't do this and I can't. And it's like, yeah, but if we understand how the brain works, then we can implement tools to be able to help and support us moving forward. So it's great that you've been able to share that.
That's a great definition in there. And in our marriage, I think in difficult or heated moments, of which I'm sure there are in all marriages, That can often be like, well, you know, don't use that as an excuse, right? And, you know, so there's an element of where, well, technically speaking, that's true. Okay. So I could say that around me is constant mess. I nearly took a video and put it on social media today of what this podcast studio and what the office looks like, because it's an absolute mess. And what happens for me with that is it's very energy draining. I don't recognize, it's not of my conscious that the mess is draining my energy. But it absolutely is, because when you get into that clean and tidy and wonderful environment, which my wife makes sure our house is all the time. I love you, wife. Thank you. I just need a wife in the office. Anyway, I went down a rabbit hole there.
You did. I'm glad we're out of that, because I was about to say hang on 1 minute and then we're like, yeah, actually come back to this.
Yeah, just come back. You know, how much better it is when things are tidy. And it's very difficult for me to find the time or the space or the energy or anything else to want to tidy. But I know that when it is tidy, that things are, you know, the energy drain, if you like, is reduced.
Yeah, no, definitely. And you mentioned about what you're doing at the minute to support people and help people. And you've spoken about this idea or helping people develop this relationship with alcohol. Do you feel for you it's related to ADHD?
Yeah, absolutely. They're totally intrinsically linked. I mean, you can look at various studies, but anything between 3, 5, and 10 times more likely to have substance misuse disorder or have an issue with substances if you are ADHD. And I'm sure there are an awful lot of neuroscience perspectives and various different things that come into play when it comes into that. But if we talk about something that we actively can change, why that, a big proportion of why that happens is that we are starting to understand how intrinsically linked stress and compulsive behavior is. In fact, I think we're really starting to understand how impactful stress is on, well, most things, illnesses, autoimmune diseases and disorders, Alzheimer's, dementia. I think we're starting to get to grips with actually we have a stress epidemic. Now, what happens when you are ADHD is because of that hyperactivity element, we have huge amounts of energy. And so we kind of train our system to be under stress. There are some interesting thoughts here, right? Which is that actually the pursuit of being busy for an ADHD person is the avoidance of feeling. So this pain from the past, which may have been a contributor to the development of ADHD, this traumatic experience or these past things here, those are painful. And so we find ourselves super busy running away from those things. Now, training ourselves to be busy means that we can handle a higher level of stress. So if you can handle a higher level of stress and you have a lot more energy, then guess what? You end up rising. You end up being successful in the environments we have today, today's society. You end up building a business. I mean, the commonalities or the similarities, sorry, the amount of ADHD and neurodivergence in business owners is just absolutely, you know, far higher levels. And there's another reason behind that is because we don't want to fit in. We don't think we fit in. And then we want to be busy. And it's like this natural place to go, well, sod that. I'm not going to work for anyone else. I'm going to go and build my own business. So this busyness kind of trains our central nervous system to be under duress significantly all the time. Now, what we see in the data, so in our programs, we use bits of technology to remotely monitor the central nervous system. We help people understand how stressed out they are getting. We help them see their stress in data, is that fundamentally, if you are stressed out all day, again, many factors come into stress. You wake up the day already in a stressed environment because you drank alcohol last night. You slept poorly because you drank alcohol last night. You're waking up already under a stressed environment. You drink coffee, which increases that stressed environment, right? You go through busy work, financial stress, things like that. This compounding of our central nervous system builds ourselves up to where the only option for us, which is this busy brain being driven by this overreactive central nervous system, nervous system is to take the edge off. Well, I can't switch my brain off. I can't get to sleep. So I need a drink. So I need something to take the edge off. And this is why people rely on that decompression, that switching off, far more likely with drugs and alcohol when they're ADHD or neurodivergent in general.
Yeah, yeah. And not a lot of people understand this, that this is what they're doing. So I've come across individuals who are on this or stuck in this cycle where it is, right, okay, I've had a long week. I'm going to have a glass of wine. I'm going to go out with my friends. And they're feeling exhausted. They're feeling tired. But in order to get the energy or to keep themselves stimulated in that is that they'll rely on the alcohol. And it's only when I'm sitting down with them and I'm breaking it down and helping them understand what's going on, they're like, oh, that's why I do it. I didn't realize that I'm an introvert, or this is what's going on for me, or this is what's happening. And this is why then I rely on this. And it's only when people have the awareness and the understanding, they can make changes. So is that what you find in your work, that people come to you and they don't make the link and the association between the, what alcohol is, what is it that alcohol is feeding in their lives?
Almost no one is doing the true math. You know, and this is why, you know, all behavior change starts with awareness. And people are at various awareness stages, you know, awareness as an example. If you take one individual who metabolizes alcohol well and one individual who metabolizes alcohol poorly, then the person who metabolizes alcohol poorly is going to get awareness sooner. And that's because the impact of alcohol has a higher hangover. The hangover lasts for longer. They really feel it the next day. There's more anxiety. There's more depression. And so it's like, well, hang on a minute. This alcohol thing is challenging me. And then you have people who metabolize alcohol well, and they're like, well, I don't really have any hangovers. Those people end up with very significant issues with drugs or alcohol because they don't have that early awareness. So for us, what we want to do, and I would say, you know, our main program, Complete Control, it's entirely about awareness. It's an 8-week journey solely to get people to do the math, right? That their drinking is just a preordained outcome of how they are living their life.
So what's the process that people go through? Like, how is it that you allow people to gain that awareness? What is it? Obviously, you don't share the course and what you're going through, but what's the overlying process that people end up going through to help them gain the awareness of this is what alcohol is doing in my life?
Yeah, that's a great question. So first of all, if we start from the top, what we realized after nearly a decade of research is that by the conversation out there into the world, which is, hey, let's stop drinking, which, you know, we were a big part of, 1 year no beer, come and do a year not drinking, all of that stuff, is actually only reaching 6% of the market, right? So when you ask the world the question, what would you like your relationship with alcohol to look like? 6% say they want to stop drinking. The other 94% said they like to have a better relationship with alcohol or reduce or various forms like that. So the conversation, 100% it is. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So you know, just touching on that, you know, the world's most successful intervention today that exists, the most successful intervention in the world for helping somebody go from alcohol use disorder to being able to drink moderately or in control, however you want to see it, which exists globally, is time. Most people grow out of alcohol use disorder over time. So of course it's possible, right? Now, one thing we're going to have to difficult. Oh yeah. So primarily what we realized is that by just saying to people, hey, come stop drinking, we're only talking to a small percentage of people. People want to be able to reduce their drinking. So, well, lots of people are in different stages. They may have tried it before. They may have never tried it before. They may be thinking about cutting back. I wish I drank less. I wish when I went out with my friends, I wasn't the one who drank so much every time. I wish that I didn't feel like I needed it each day just to survive kids, family, work. I wish that I could just stop at one, right? This is where it starts for people. And at the moment, the vast majority of the resources out there in the world say, okay, you'll have to stop. And they're like, but I don't want to. I don't want to stop. So there's a massive gap in supporting people in that place. And that's why we wanted to develop more tools and resources to help people there and say, look, we can support you on this journey. The truth may be for you that the only way you have true control is to not drink at all. That may be the truth, but why not at least start going on this journey together, supported in that guidance? Because this is a sliding scale. It's not an on-off switch. So how did it actually work? Well, after years of research, I've spent some time with some of the top scientists in the world. I've worked at the German Neuroscience Hospital. I've put myself under the knife, testing all sorts of different things and obviously studied the materials. Like we know from science what drives compulsive behavior. So what we did is just design a program that uses technology, that uses various devices, that uses various coaching to help people see with clarity which of these drivers is driving it for them, and then give them a roadmap for changing those drivers. And this launched 2 years ago. It's a very pioneering program. What are they? We started off with 12. We've refined those down to 10 core drivers. When we look at those core drivers, really number one, which is the vast majority of the source of our desire to take the edge off, right? Which is our source of, oh, I really just need a drink. Or once I start going for one, I have another one. I can't stop. And then I black out, or I have these issues, or I throw up, or I cause problems. The number one source for the vast majority of the people is our past experiences as a child. And there's lots of movement in here. Some people say, well, I had a wonderful childhood. Well, you don't really understand the concept here. I'll just want to explain something important. During 0 to 7, our prefrontal cortex, which is the area of the brain just behind the forehead, has not yet really switched on. And we use that for rational decision making, for understanding the world around us, for all of that. So when we're shouted at, when we're left alone to cry out in our room, when we're denied love, or when we are not recognized or given affirmation or any of those things, we feel an intense emotion that we don't understand. Look at a baby that's been left alone from its mother for, you know, crying. It's an incredible amount of emotion, unable to regulate. And we're not taught how to regulate. We are, in fact, the opposite. We're taught to pack it down and ignore it. Come on, pick yourself up, be strong, be there, come on. So we pack down those emotions. And during that early childhood time, there's some really interesting research that's showing that those emotions are trapped inside of us. Wonderful book, The Body Keeps the Score by Bessel van der Kolk. You've read it. So these emotions, these feelings inside of us, these old feelings are toxic and incredibly hard to deal and feel. So if I link that to today as an example, and let's say you come home and you're like, oh, I just want to have a drink. What's happening in that moment could be something like, it could be stress. It could be boredom. Right now, boredom is interesting because boredom attaches to loneliness. And loneliness is one of the most intense feelings we had as a child. It was just so powerful. We were left alone forever. We never knew if people were going to come back together. And so we feel boredom that immediately attaches back to that old, we instantly can't cope. This doesn't happen in the conscious. You're not sitting there thinking, oh, I was so lonely as a child. It happens instantaneously. And you go, right, I need to avoid this feeling right now. And I'm going to go and get something to do that. And it could be Netflix. It could be cake. It could be porn. It could be something to soothe me immediately now. So what we know is that this is the vast majority of the source. And if that's the case, then what we need to try and do with somebody is A, help them get aware of these parts of themselves. Like what part of you is feeling lonely? What part of you, and you know, things like internal family systems is really powerful at this that we use. And then help people consciously choose an alternative path. And inside there is a lot of the awareness of our past trauma, our childhood experiences is like, okay, I understand that that's how I felt as a child, but that's not how I feel today. And it's okay that I felt like that then, but I'm actually okay just now. And I can soothe myself without reaching for something. And when it gets into the awareness, now we can start to change how we operate around it. This one element here is a game changer for most people. You know, I've had, this is board level at one of the largest pharmaceuticals say to me, Ruri, this has changed who I am. I had a lady who was at one of the top four big accounting firms, and she was sitting in the second position she had for many years, frustrated that she hadn't been promoted to go up into the next level. And she realized that something her uncle said to her at 4 years old made her believe that she was not worthy. And she'd been running around, furiously trying to prove the world that she is worthy, rising meteorically, very successful in her organization, but would never get to the top. And the reason why she would never get to the top is because she doesn't feel worthy. And so when she gets awareness of that pattern, and then she consoles herself and says, I am worthy, that's when the doors open. She has been promoted. And this is like a game changer for understanding our past experiences. So that's just one element of what we look at. I'm just going to skate quickly through the others because you did ask. So stress, such a core driver. Again, we use a device. Most people are not only not dealing with their stress. So they're thinking, oh my God, I'm so stressed out, right? We now know from science that how you perceive your stress is how you will handle your stress. If you're constantly running around, you're saying, I'm so stressed out and completely overwhelmed, well, you're right. If you're like, okay, I've got this, I can do this, I can handle this stress, I've been here before, I know I can get through this, then guess what? You will get through it. So that's a really important factor. The other thing here is to understand that because of the things that we're doing, the way we are living, the lack of calm that we're finding in our day, the compounding on the central nervous system all day, we're actually self-sabotaging our stress coping mechanisms. And alcohol is the worst tool. It debilitates our ability to deal with stress. It increases overwhelm, increases feelings of not able to handle stress. So therefore, you get more stressed out and need a drink again. So helping people unwind that. And then more importantly, putting in the small tools to help them get parasympathetic during the day. We're seeing in the data that when you get parasympathetic during the day, that's what calms down the central nervous system. That's what allows good sleep at night. Good sleep at night then allows you to get more parasympathetic during the day. This allows you to handle much higher levels of calm. I had a guy who runs a $500 million turnover cybersecurity business come through our program and say, Ruri, I don't think I've ever had so many fires in my business, and I don't think I've ever been calmer. So, you know, going through that process, these are life-changing tools. You want to change your relationship with alcohol, but actually we're going to help you optimize your whole life.
You were on a beautiful flow there. I didn't want to disrupt you, but my brain was literally buzzing from the inside because I'm like, yes, yes, yes. Like the work that you're doing is so beautiful. And the reason why I'm like cheering you on is because a lot of what we do go through is it does come from our childhood. And often people say, well, my childhood was absolutely fine. But behind every individual who has this this relationship with alcohol is that little boy or little girl who is dysregulated, who doesn't feel enough, who something has happened where they have this belief system that I'm not worthy. And that's where like this relationship with alcohol is, let me just soothe this little child because I don't know what else to do. And that's really sad, really, really sad. And even when you were saying, you were mentioning, I wish I was like this. I wish I was. And it's like so many people behind the relationship with alcohol, which will already have a lot of shame attached to that, is this wishing of a different way, but not knowing the other way.
The important part that we're resonating so strongly with there is, hey, we're asking people to go in search of sobriety. We're asking people to take a break for January, take a break for February, which is a wonderful thing to do physiologically. It's a wonderful thing to do. You're going to feel better. You're going to improve your life. Any amount of drinking less is a positive thing. And we're not telling them to go and do the work. We're just telling them to do that thing. So they take a break. Then they go back to drinking again, just like they were. Sometimes worse, right? Because we know aversion therapy doesn't work. We know saying, do not think of that big, that pink elephant. That doesn't work. So I'm going to avoid this thing that I have all of this desire for. I'm going to hold on with willpower. And then I'm going to wonder why my relationship with it is getting worse over time. We are not helping people by doing that. The important thing is to say, hey, guys, let's not just go in search of sobriety, right? Stopping drinking is not the answer. It's a wonderful tool. It's an amazing tool that will give you all the resources that you need, energy, productivity, clarity, focus, like the ability to really work on yourself. But the way to get control, the way to have a better relationship with alcohol over time is to do the work. And that is absolutely what will help you get control. And whether control is not drinking at all or drinking now and again or slowing down the binge, it's about doing the work.
And like you just said, it's not just about, okay, this is the problem. This is what keeps causing the problem. Let me get rid of that. It's deeper than that, because that's come in as a way of you soothing something else deeper that's going on. So if you get rid of that, then something else is going to come up. And I've got a book coming out next month, and it's High Functioning Anxiety. And that's what this is. Everything that we're speaking about is about this, is that there's somewhere within us that we don't feel enough, and we become this high functioning individual, but it's stemmed from a place of not feeling worthy, not feeling good enough. And that then causes this anxiety, which is hidden. People don't see this anxiety. So you go, 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 go. Everyone sees you as being successful, someone who's organized, got everything together. But behind the scenes, you're dysregulated. You don't know how to manage your big emotions. And as a result, you just keep pushing yourself down these unhealthy strategies. And that's the same with alcohol. If we remove that, something else is going to get put in. If we remove that, something else is going to get put in. And it is about doing the work and going deeper, just as you've mentioned. So when you were speaking, I was like, yes, inside, just cheering you on, because this is beautiful work, really beautiful work.
And you too, you know, the anxiety level, and, you know, just how anxiety creating alcohol is, you know, it is a significant depressant. It stimulates anxious thoughts by the way it interacts with our central nervous system, driving that busy brain where it just creates that. And so if you've got a busy brain that has a depressant attached into it, you're going to have more anxious, more fearful thoughts. And, you know, what we now know is the alcohol is specifically, you know, targeting or attacking the prefrontal cortex. We know that it depletes the prefrontal cortex. And so inside there, you know, we're seeing all sorts of signs of things like honesty and where our prefrontal cortex is that we start to get more and more depressed and more anxious over time. And more importantly, right, it's also increasing the production of cortisol. Right. So alcohol increases the production of cortisol over time, which means it makes it more likely for us to go into that fight or flight state. So this is what I say to business owners all the time. You know, you're feeling these anxious or these depressed things at the moment. Every sip of drink you take, you're going to increase the amount of anxiousness, the amount of depressing thoughts and feelings that you're going to have over time, and reduce your ability to deal with stress. The if you shoot that out into the distance, right, and keep going on the direction you're going, it's filled with more anxious thoughts, more depression, more lowness, more sadness, right? But more inability to deal with stress. And a lot of people, when you attach it to the stress, they're like, well, hang on a minute, that is absolutely not what I want. You know, I'm trying to build a business here. I'm trying to increase my career. I'm trying to get up the ladder. And it's like, okay, well, if you look at this data here, which we've now shown you, and I think, again, I had one guy come through the program. He's a veteran of the personal development industry, an honor to have him come through the program. And he said, look, I've been in the personal development industry for 35 years. I've signed up to all the programs out there, right? I've coached one-to-one with Bob Proctor. I've coached one-to-one with Tony Robbins, my hero. And he said, your program has changed me more and had a bigger impact on me than all the other programs combined. And I mean, he just compared me to Tony Robbins, my hero.
That is huge. Huge.
And he said, it's because of the data and the evidence that you are showing. It's so compelling. And so this is what we want to do. We want to bring you to the table a bit like when the dog wheezes on the carpet, right? And you bring it over and you go, look at you, smell, right? A bit like that. We really bring people to the table. This is what you are doing to your body, your brain. This is what's happening to your life. This is the truth about this consumption of alcohol that you're doing here. And more importantly, on this journey together, we're going to say, you know, what is it you do want? Who are you? Right? What do you want to achieve in the world? Meaning and purpose, major driver of compulsive behavior. Right. And so they go, well, I want to do this. And then you help them see through this journey. Do you realize that everything that you want to be happy, to be healthy, to be successful, to leave a legacy, to build a successful business, to, you know, double your business this year, to be running around the garden with your grandkids, to be in good health in your final years, to have optimal health, to have peak performance, everything that you are looking for is actually being taken away by alcohol. And when they see that, the light goes on and they're like, oh my God, Like, how often do you want to add something like that in? Look, I think it's okay. If you want to go and take drugs now and again, do it. Like, why not? Let it go. If you want to go and drink alcohol now and again, do it. But know the risks. Know the truth. This thing is killing you. It's 100% toxic. It's 100% poison. It's hurting your brain and it's taking everything from you. So just don't do it very often.
And what I always say is people that don't understand that this is what alcohol is doing, it's like they've got this open loop. And because they don't have like the rest of the information, what they do is they walk around with these open loops, not understanding, but continuing these patterns. But it's only when you show the mirror and you help them to understand, they're like, oh my goodness, I didn't understand. And like you said, just beautifully, you just illustrated, it's that light bulb moment. So people get that light bulb moment and they think and they realize and they have that closed loop and they're like, I get it now. And then they can make a different choice and a different decision. But if they don't understand, they're not going to do anything. And when you were talking, I had a question is I often get people need to be ready to want to look in the mirror. So you're there, you're showing people like all their stats and everything. Do you feel like everyone that comes your way, are they all ready for this change? Do you find that?
Introducing our exclusive newsletter, your weekly dose of inspiration, insights, and empowerment. Each week we deliver curated content straight to your inbox. And this is designed to help you navigate life's challenges and thrive. Join our community of like-minded individuals who are committed to personal growth and self-discovery. Subscribe now to start your journey towards a happier, more fulfilling life. Don't miss out.
This is a part of the system that has been helping people with addiction for, well, 100 years plus, I don't know. There are the 12-step sort of system. And it's predominantly based on, or a lot of the conversation out there is, they have to be ready. And in fact, I have an ex-AA guy on my team, in our sales team. He's a wonderful, wonderful guy, cares so much for people. He was a big part of AA and Cocaine and Anonymous for a long time. And now he sees the work we are doing. He's just inspired by us being able to help a wider audience of people. Is that he used to say that, look, call me back when you've had enough. Call me back when you reach rock bottom. That makes my toes curl. It is so wrong. No, you know, the thing is to say there's nothing we can do until that person has fucked their life up enough that they submit that they want to change. I just don't believe that's true. I think one word could change somebody. Lalita, this podcast could be the thing that changes somebody's life for good. I get comments every single day about the videos and the message that I put out. People saying, I didn't sign up to the program, but I have transformed my life. That's incredible. Some words could change somebody's life. But think about it for a second. If it wasn't just words, what about a pill? I mean, somebody could take a pill and suddenly change. Somebody might go and do an ayahuasca experience and never drink again. Stop talking about this whole somebody needs to be ready. Okay, willingness needs to be there for somebody to take action. But I still believe that we can help create willingness in someone. Sit me down next to anyone and enough time and I can help them change. I guarantee it. Like, I promise you, we can help everyone go on this journey. And I think the big thing here as well is, let's just talk about this as a journey. It's not on or off. It's not, are you an alcoholic or are you not? It's not black and white. It's just a journey of self-discovery. I don't know where you're at with your relationship with alcohol right now. You could be the equivalent in personal training terms of seriously obese. You might be on the bed eating pizza every day, 800 pounds, whatever, 200 kilos, right? And it's like, wow, well, how are we going to get you fit? That's going to be a difficult journey. But can we do it? Of course we can. So let's talk about this same thing of alcohol showing up in a prevalent way in your life, that this is a personal development journey that we can go on.
Yeah. And it's like people, sometimes they wear blinkers, don't they, in life? They wear blinkers and they're just carrying on through life. But if you're there making noise and letting people know, people then feel the safety to like undo them blinkers and just have a look at what's going on and take what they need. Because if you're saying, oh, no, no, you carry on, you fall over and fall into the ditch and then maybe I'll help you then, because then you desperately need support. But if you're making noise beforehand, people can take what they want, can't they, from
that? Yeah, exactly. And everything we're doing here is about helping people earlier. You know, all I want to do is, I think prevention should always swim upstream, and I just want to keep going upstream. I want to be there at the hangover. I want my products and my services and all of the things that we provide to be there at the moment somebody's in the hangover, that will help people see in data, that will help people see and get awareness and like think, hang on a minute, you know, this thing is really not doing me any good, and give alternative paths to support people. There is one thing I would say, which is really important. I know you know this, and I think you can also, I think you'll be saying this to people as well, because it's really important. In this awareness journey, which some people listening to this may already have been in a significant, right, sober journey, or try and stop drinking and then drink and then stop drinking and then problematic drinking. And they're like, look, Ruri, Lalita, I'm aware, right? I'm aware of these things. I'm everything you've said I'm doing or I do, but it keeps coming back. So why is that? And there's something really important, is that at the end of the day, no amount of conscious work will ever outdo a self-sabotaging subconscious. Okay. And this is the deep, deep stuff that we need to dig in. I now just do some really simple math for me. If there is compulsion, then I have work on this past stuff to do. It's driven predominantly by those past old feelings that I haven't let go of. And that's what I want to help people see as well. And in knowing that, right, in knowing that, if that's the truth for people, then it just sends them on a journey of doing more therapy, trying a different therapist. Bessa van der Kolk says, let us not call it treatment-resistant depression. Right? Let us just say we haven't found the right tool for the right person. So if alcohol is still showing up for you and you've been doing the work, don't stop. It's just about finding the right tools for you. And there are so many different ways to go at this.
And when you say that, for me, pivot comes up, is pivoting to try to understand and not being hard on yourself if what you're doing isn't getting you the results that you're expecting of yourself. Because even that in itself is, there's learning from that. Because do you have these high expectations that because I'm doing the work, I'm never going to go into alcohol in this way, or I'm going to continue life in this way. And then when you do feel like you're falling, you're not falling. It's just another shadow part of you that we need to integrate into ourselves, into our conscious self, to be able to become more aware of it. So do you have an example of someone who has continued on the journey and then have got to a point where they're like, forget this, it's not working for me, or something else now has come up?
Is this an example of somebody who has failed at, or in brackets failed? I mean, I think that's where lots and lots and lots of people end up. They go into this cycle of stopping. I mean, you know, you could look at a chap, Kev, who came on our program, he had nearly given up, I think. I've had a lot of people who I bring back from almost deciding to, you know, end their life. One chap came out on our retreat, in fact, and we did a cliff jumping experience. I've gone off on a tangent.
No. This is really interesting. I was really sad because I was like, oh, my brain went into, I wonder how many people end up taking their lives because they're not able to support themselves and they don't have the tools.
ADHD and suicide, the numbers are just horrendous.
That's where my brain went. But I was focused on what you were saying about this guy who went on the retreat and you were doing a cliff jumping exercise.
He's a successful business owner. And, you know, he came out on the retreat, and part of the retreat was taking them through a process, awareness, who do they want to be, changing some limiting beliefs. It was an amazing experience. And then at the end, they got to jump off a cliff to leave their old selves behind and turn into the new version of themselves. And it was a big psychological element around that. And he jumped off the cliff. And then afterwards that evening, he was quite hesitant over it. Afterwards that evening, he said, you know, 2 weeks before this, I was standing on a bridge with a suicide note and decided, I think I've just come to this retreat to see what happens. He actually messaged me the other day, and he's doing so well and moved on to his new life and made some huge changes in his life as of that experience with us. The reason why I brought that up is I was talking about Kev, who, you know, he'd gone three times to the Priory. Now, typically, you know, when it's very, very, very problematic drinking is on the level of whether we can support them or not. We'll always work with a GP, we'll always work with a local healthcare service. Perhaps they'll go through a detox first, but we're a coaching business, and so we need to support people from that perspective. But you know, he'd done the Priory three times previously, three times within weeks gone back to how he was. And then he, you know, came on our program. Wind forward, you know, almost a year later after coming through our program, he comes out, flies out to Mallorca where I live with my wife, takes us out for dinner. And he sat and he had half a glass of wine. And he's like, now, whenever I drink, I never finish it. And this is part of our program, because if we want to have control over our drinking, then we actually have to build those neural pathways. Just like learning how to drive a car, we have to teach ourselves how to do that. And the more you teach yourself how to do it, the more likely you are to be able to have that skill, if you like. And this comes way after a lot of the deep work and doing things like that. So, you know, there is somebody who probably could have just ended up broken in the system or dead, who came and had a massive transformation by coming through our program.
I think that's beautiful, because I've worked in spaces like the Priory, and I can see the how the programs run and what can not help people. So just hearing that and understanding that people are coming to you and you're just getting to the root of what's going on. But it's not just, okay, come to me and here in this space, you are going to so-called be healed. It's here are the tools that you need to continue life with. So whatever setting you're in, these are the tools that you can continue to dive into to use, rather than let's just do it here. And then now you go back into your old life and you're putting them back in, and there's going to be loads of triggers there. There's going to be loads of different experiences. So there's this ongoing support system that's needed. So I honestly really appreciate it. But when you're speaking about I can really feel the passion and I can really feel the work that you're doing and wanting this support. Where does it all stem from for you, from your perspective, from your journey?
Yes. Well, ADHD didn't fit in, 6 years old. My parents were given an ultimatum, drugs or counselling. And I'm very lucky. I believe I'm lucky that they chose counselling, because it started this process of me trying to understand what was going on in my brain. And then pretty much through my life, I was always in therapy. You know, every single decade, I was doing different types of therapy. I was working, you know, psychoanalysts, psychotherapists, counsellors, CBT, psychodynamic therapy, all sorts of stuff.
Was that out of choice?
Yes, out of choice. Yeah. Yeah. And it is because inside me, so when I was 14 and I tried to commit suicide at 13 and then again at 14. And after my second attempt, my parents were really hoping that I would pull through. And my dad used to work for Childline, and he knew that giving kids hope was one of the best ways. So he encouraged me to write a letter to somebody that inspired me. So I wrote a letter to Richard Branson, and I said, amongst the many things, I'm going to change the world one day, and I'm looking forward to having lunch with you. No ego there.
that's not ego. That's hope.
Yeah. And then, you know, set up my first business at 15, 5 companies by the time I was 25. I was a serial failpreneur, no success there, but just tried and tried and tried. Then through the TV program, The Apprentice, which I was on series 2, contestant number 15. There were only 14 contestants. I ended up becoming an oil broker in London. And I kind of forgot about the impact I wanted to have in the world, because I got paid too much and I drank too much. And partied a wonderful time, met my wife, you know, lots of fun and all of that kind of stuff. It was great. But then it started to cause me a bit too much problems, alcohol. And then I took a break from alcohol. Couldn't believe it. You know, fitter, faster, healthier, happier, better dad, better husband, grew my business, all of those things. I think through that process and a random meeting with the Dalai Lama, which I launched 1 year, no beer. Then I got to meet the Dalai Lama, which was a life-changing moment for me. And when that happened, I knew why I was put on the planet. I was like, I know what I'm here to do. And so I went in on the Monday morning and I handed in my notice. And my boss was like, you know, you don't need to. You're spending 70% of your time building this business anyway. We don't care. You're a very successful broker. Just don't care. And I was like, I can't do it. I have to be all in on this thing. And I think that's the other thing, is you know, being mission driven and doing something for purpose and helping people, I can't think of any other way to live. And I wrote something the other day because I know Mo Gaudat was on Stephen Butler's podcast, and he was saying to all the AI engineers out there, if you're working on AI for bad right now, and it's not AI for good, stop, down tools and work on AI for good. This is the only way we're going to get it to go in the right direction. And I think similarly for us as human beings, we have to be aligned in meaning and purpose. And many, many, many ADHDers are empaths, and empaths need to give back. And so what we do is, because we're not giving back, because we're not helping other people, then we need to soothe, then we need to take the edge off, because we can't live in the version we're living in. The good news is, for many people, you know, I've had people who are senior at financial institutions say to me, great, you know, thanks, Rory. I've realized I hate the finance industry. What do you want me to do now? Is that when it comes to meaning and purpose and compulsive behavior, is that direction is as powerful as destination. Okay. So we don't actually have to be, I don't know, digging wells in third world countries, whatever it is, for us to feel that sense of meaning and purpose. We just have to be clear that that's the direction we're going. And when you're clear that that's the direction you're going, you'll start listening to podcasts, you'll start studying it, you'll start putting money aside for that mission that you've got, and that calms down.
And sometimes it is about doing our inner work. Like when you're doing your inner work, that's where you start to meet your purpose, meet what it is that you feel like gives you that fire in your belly. I find that that's where that can come up.
Oh, absolutely. Because people are like, I don't know what it is, and I don't know where. And you're like, well, you're all out here. Yeah, it doesn't come from there. It comes from in here.
And, you know, when you were talking about your journey, I can't help but think about your 13, 14 year old self. And if you don't mind me asking, what was it that was going on for you where you wanted to leave this world?
Yeah, it's an interesting one, because I think, you know, that decision or that want to leave is this belief that everything is going to get better for everyone else when you're not around, and that you're the source of the problems for other people. And the pain is so great. And I think, you know, when I look at that, of course, there was lots of things going on. There was bullying. There was not feeling a part of a disconnection from the community I lived in, disconnection around, because of that hyperactivity. That hyperactive, I would lie a lot, make up stories to try and get attention. And then it would just come back in negative attention, and it would drive that thing. I would constantly try and get this attention, but then that negativity would come back, which kind of drives that more. So I think it was, you know, large feelings of helplessness, hopelessness, and not wanting to be there. And then I think, you know, later in life, I've been close back there again, various stages. And I think it's I know it's a very common thing with ADHD, because it's so misunderstood in society, because our behavior is not conducive to how society exists in the world. It very much drives all of those thoughts and feelings, that we are wrong, that we are bad. I actually got a big tattoo on my back to remind me of the devil on my back. You know, it's like that devil self-destruct blow up, will always be a part of me. And I think over time you don't learn to tame with it. You learn to come at peace with it. And you also learn to let it off sometimes. You know, it needs to be there. So again, inside here, most people, when, you know, you look at drugs and alcohol as a part, I think it's, you know, over 50% of suicides, drugs and alcohol are involved. And that, you know, the erosion of the prefrontal cortex is what pushes people over the edge, because you're no longer using rational thought. It's been diluted by alcohol and drugs. So that's why the propensity becomes in there. So I would say to people who are feeling those feelings, like the alcohol is only taking you down that road in a far more significant place. And you know, the reaching out for help is one thing. It's often hard to do because you just want to curl up into the ball.
There's so much shame, isn't there? There's so much shame that people carry around when it comes to alcohol, and this shame of, first of all, there's a problem, or there's this disconnection with yourself, and then we've got this reliance. But people not understanding that, they just see it as, people are going to see I've got a problem. And it's this negative association as well, that if there's alcohol involved, that means there's something wrong with you. So you're carrying around all of these different belief systems that stop you getting from support. But like you've just said, this support isn't just a support to change the relationship with alcohol. It changes everything. It changes your relationship with your family, with romantic partners, with your work, everyday work, but most importantly, with how you look after yourself. And I wonder if that's what you've noticed since your relationship with alcohol changed.
Yeah, well, everything's changed. I mean, my life is totally different. I was, you know, an oil broker in central London, blah, 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 blah. And I think all of those things are factors. You know, if I look at, you know, commuting via windowless office to central London, and being in a very, very high stress environment in a role I didn't feel particularly connected to and I wasn't helping people, those are all significant drivers of compulsive behavior. Sleep deprivation on top of that, not exercising on top of that. I mean, the list goes on and on and on. You're like, well, there's no surprise. You're drinking heavily, right? That shock horror, you know, but then nobody's doing that math, and that math has not been connected for people. Let's talk about the visit to the doctors, right? You know, in the world that we live in today, hey, I'm feeling anxious and depressed. I feel really significantly depressed. Okay, here's a pill, right? One in three people in the UK are on antidepressants. No antidepressant in some studies has beaten the placebo, less than 3% success rate. We're basically taking, you know, sugar pills, or, you know, and with significant, I mean, over 50% of people experience side effects. Significant side effects, right? Nuts. So, but hang on, where was the conversation of, okay, so what's your sleep like? Because sleep deprivation is a major driver of depression and anxiety. But do you drink alcohol? Because alcohol is 100% successful as a depressant. It's making those depressant thoughts. What about exercise? Are you exercising? No, those conversations are not happening. And instead, it's issuing a pill. And those three are so significant drivers of compulsive behavior.
Just really sad, isn't it? That you're going to a professional to try and get support. You're saying that these are my symptoms, this is what's going on. But you don't even know, like the GP usually has like 10, 15 minutes here in the UK. And it's like, right, okay, what's going on? What's happening? Let's give you what you need. And not all GPs are like that, but they are also very constrained in their time. So it's like, do you have the space to really sit with someone and go through what is it that's going on here? What is it that's happening here? And to be able to give them the resources of what they need?
Completely. We have GPs who come through the program, and a lot of them are in a very, very, very poor shape. I mean, suicide rate is going through the roof. Disillusionment with their role, inability to be able to actually help people, feeling like they're not helping people, they're actually making people worse. stress levels through the roof. Excuse me. So, I mean, and the system is not geared up for that. It's definitely better in the UK. I've got one of the a guy who has 2,500 doctors in his institution, and he came through the program recently. He wants to help us bring it more into the US, and he said, you know, it's an absolute war zone for doctors right now. It's just horrendous. And he said, 2 years ago, we pivoted the whole business to focus on holistic health. It was diet, exercise, sleep, you know, meditation, these wonderful tools. And 18 months later, we nearly went bust. And so we had to turn back to focusing on lining the pockets of the pharmaceuticals. And so we know this with the healthcare industry, especially in the US, it's not a healthcare. It's not about health. It's about selling more pills. And this is why we need to change that conversation and empower people just with the basics, right? Compulsion is showing up for you. Let's start with the basics. Let's get sleep right. Let's exercise. Let's find some calm during the day. Let's stop drinking alcohol.
If there's no one around someone saying these things, and if they are saying I'm anxious, okay, what comes to mind, GP? If I'm feeling depressed, what comes to mind? I must need medication to make it better. But that's not the thing that's going to make it better. So it's almost like people aren't being, it's raising that awareness of there is another path. There's another path. And this is what it looks like. And this is what is about, rather than just being consumed with, but there is like, what else, what other support am I meant to have? And people, even when they come into the therapy space, they'll say to me, they'll be like, I've tried this, nothing works. I'm like, okay, we're not going to talk about any medication. We're just going to talk through your life journey and just to try and make sense of, this is who you are right now in front of me. These are all the symptoms you're talking to me about, but I want to go beyond that. I want to look beyond what these symptoms are about, because that's just ways that you found to feel safe, to cope in the world. But there's something else that's going on. And often, more than anything, it's we're disconnected from ourselves. We've learned to live outside in rather than inside out. And it's a lot of ADHD individuals as well that will come in and they'll say that, well, when I was a child, I was told you're too much, or stop being so loud, or just be a good girl, or just be like this, or just, so you're doing all these, you've been told all these different messages. So you've suppressed yourself and learned to people please, or learned to focus on what other people want, be a perfectionist, be this hard working individual, try and be organized, because if you were clumsy and dropped something, you were told off constantly. So then you became fearful of, I better now be on my best behavior and do this. And I see this so often in the therapy space, where people have learned not to just be themselves, just to show up as who they are, because they don't know who that is, because they've learned so much about, I need to focus on what other people want from me. Do you see that?
100%. 100%.
Yeah.
So many people are operating on patterns of the past, and all of us are in different ways operating on patterns based on things that happened to us in our childhood. And that's what's insane. There's a great body of work, again, looking at what happens. So in those moments of these beliefs created as a child, those then kind of get locked into our subconscious. I'm not worthy. That our subconscious is the thing that's creating right now. I don't know where everyone sits on the sliding scale of manifestation and creating the world, right? That's a sliding scale. You're not just going to sit down and suddenly visualize $1 million and it will appear, right? But we do know for sure that what we focus on takes us in the direction. What we think about, what we focus on, the things that our brain are doing are creating more of. So if you're thinking in your subconscious, I'm not worthy, then you are constantly creating situations to prove yourself true. And our ego does this for us, right? So it comes in, all of a sudden enters something that you shouldn't enter, or goes into a room where you're like, ta-da, like this. And people are like, oh, you know what? And your ego goes, see, you're not worthy. I told you, here's proof. And you don't even know that's happening. You're going, oh, I'm not worthy. But your ego is going, yes, I proved it once again. And this pattern is happening on overdrive behind. Wow. I mean, I think what you said back there was so powerful, because, you know, you've written a book, such a powerful book about anxiety, and lots of people will go, oh, I have anxiety, I'm going to read that book. And then in that, you're going to open them up to this entire world of tools and resources that they can say, well, I can implement that. And, oh, I didn't write awareness in a book, which is so powerful. You know, not that I'm telling everyone not to go to their GP and read books, but maybe. But here's the other thing. When we get to a world where we're saying to people, when they come into that state, like, well, what happened to you? What are the things that happened in the past? Even autoimmune diseases, right? We have a lady who came through a month before. So she got diagnosed with an autoimmune disorder, and then she had to change her diet and things like that. That's what the doctor had recommended. So she's like, right, I'm going to do, you know, the complete control program of the OIMB. So a month after being diagnosed, she comes through the complete control program. And then I think it was 6 weeks or 8 weeks after the program, she went back in for a test. No signs of autoimmune disease.
And what does that tell you? What is that telling you about the relationship between our emotional selves versus our body and how our body keeps the score? Because we are so focused on, I need to do this, I need to do this. But actually, in the background, yes, we've disconnected from our body, but the body is still taking on everything that we're doing in this way. So it's like, we're high functioning, we're here, we're driven, we're go, 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 go. But your body is with you all the time. And I think that's why it's so important, even the work that you're doing right now, and the passion that you have, I really feel the fire in your belly. And it's like, yes, we want to really help people. It's not just about giving someone, here's a book and this is what we're going to go through. It feels like you really sit with people. You see them. You really hear them. You really see what's going on beyond. And I think there's something really beautiful there, because your work isn't just surface level. It's getting to the root of what's going on for individuals. And that does stem from what's gone on as a child and beliefs that are in their subconscious. And like you said, their ego just saying, yep, yep, yep. See, we're going to keep you safe now because this is what we believe you are. So you're going to continue this way. But you're like, no, no, no. We're going to work through that, but giving people the tools that they need. So I'm really appreciative that you've just been able to share just a small fraction of your life and what you're doing and the mission that you're on. And at some point, I'm hoping that you get to sit with Richard Branson and have that cup of tea and let him know that this is what I'm here for. This is my mission. This is what I want to see in people.
I did. I did.
That's amazing. How did that go?
The final part of the story was, over years, every investor, you know, I've raised from thousands of investors and every investor pitch, everything I would mention about the Lester Branson, I just kept putting it out over years, you know, 7-8 years. I just kept putting the message out, And then I found out that somebody very close to him, his water sports instructor, had done 1 year no beer and was a member. And I reached out and spoke. And then another person that was close, a photographer, and reached out and spoke. So I knew we were getting closer and closer. And then randomly, just before COVID, I got a message from someone who I knew in the US saying, a friend of a friend of one of our investors. And he said, look, I've just seen your video about Branson. I'm actually going down to hang out with him in Necker Island. Do you want to come? And I was like, yes, this is amazing. I can't believe it's going to happen. So I spoke to the organizer and he was like, oh my God, I can't believe your story. I'm going to sit next to Richard. It's going to be amazing. He's going to love this story, you know, what you're doing. And he's really passionate about that. So I was very excited. And then about a month before due to go to Necker Island, COVID hit. And so it canceled. And I was looking forward to, you know, sitting next to Branson and FaceTiming my dad and being like, hey, look, I made it and it happened. And then sadly, my dad died a few months later. So I never got to do that. And then wind forward another couple of years and we moved out to Mallorca here, which is an amazing island. And he has a hotel here. And I woke up 1-2 o'clock in the morning or whatever, you know, couldn't sleep one night. And I woke up and I saw front page of the Mallorca Daily Bulletin. Branson is here, is opening the hotel. So I thought, you know what, I'm just going to go up there. And so I just drove up to this hotel. And as I arrived, there was like camera crew and people. And I was like, I probably shouldn't be here. And I was like, can I grab a coffee? And they were like, yeah, sure. Just head out to the terrace. And I kid you not, like of all the places he could be, I walked out into this terrace and he was standing in a pulpit on his own, just looking out to the view. And I don't know how often Richard Branson is standing on his own without an entourage of people and cameras. But at that moment, so I just walked up beside him and I said, what an amazing view. And he was like, it's one of my favorite in the world. And I said, Richard, can I tell you a story? And he said, is it funny? And I said, no, but I might cry. And he said, well, go on then. And so I started telling him the story. And when I got to the part about my dad dying, I cried and he stopped and he gave me a hug. He was so nice and so gracious. And then he let me get this whole story out and about the impact and the work that we were doing. And he said, you know, it's amazing. I'd love to support you. We'll get something out on social media, which he did. He pushed it out on social media about meeting me in a wonderful picture. It's up on his Instagram and all of that. It's up on LinkedIn. And then he said, look, you might not get that with your father, but why not have dinner with us tonight? So, my wife came up and we had dinner with him and some friends of his, which was just like hanging out with friends of Richard Branson for a night, which was so cool. An amazing, amazing experience.
It happened. And can you just, there's something about just following your intuition, following your instinct. So that in that morning you woke up and it was like, you know what, let me just look at it. Let me just go there and look at what's happened, just following that intuition. And it's happened. I'm really, really pleased to hear that.
It was cool because it was, for me, it was more about my dad, you know, and it was about making him proud and all that stuff. So, yeah, it was great. An amazing experience. And hopefully the first of a few because, you know, Rich is an amazing human and he's quite sympathetic to the message of helping the world drink less alcohol.
Yeah. Who knows? Watch this space. It's just chapter one and there'll be many more. So thank you. Thank you for sharing that. That was really beautiful. And it's a great way of closing this podcast as well. Just that magic piece. Because there's me wishing you and you're like, yeah, I did. I was like, what? Hang on a minute. We need to get this. This is brilliant. But it's just that's really heart touching, like just how it did happen. This one hope that you've always had and that hope that your dad gave you. Like, come on, I want you. This is what you'll do. Write this letter. And that's what you did. And
it's
and
amazing
it happened.
How powerful hope is for people. I think an awful lot of people feel hopeless. And, you know, alcohol is hopelessness in a bottle. And, you know, if we can just get them to take that step, you know, little baby steps. And that's what I'm all about. You know, and if anybody is listening and, you know, needs any support in this area, then by all means, come and check us out. You know, I'm very active on Instagram. So you can find me R Fairbairns on Instagram. Then 1 year no beer is either OYMB on all channels, or 1 year no beer. We have lots and lots of different tools and resources. We have our own podcast, which is on pause at the moment. But when it is, we need to get you on, Lalita, and talk about your wonderful book. There's lots of free resources, you know, to support people wherever they're at. So, yeah. And my last thought here is, of all the things, I truly, truly believe, you know, that alcohol is like the one thing. It kind of... taking a break from alcohol or choosing to change your relationship with alcohol opens a doorway to everything else. It opens a doorway to allow you to exercise. You want to focus on your better health. You want to do the work. You want to look after yourself. You want to improve your relationship. You want to get better at your job, whatever it is. It really is the one thing that will open the door to everything else. And if you need any help, you know where I am.
And I'll share your links as well underneath this podcast. But if there was one thing that you could say to someone right now, just as an ending, I know you're trying to put it in, Matt, but I'm like, no, we're going to make it separate. What would you say is the one thing that you would like someone to take away to hear as an ending?
Dead simple. Let's just make 2024 the year you drink less. And let's just go on that nice, simple journey together of what it is. Any amount less is going to help and support you. And if you can get to not drinking or drinking not at all, that's going to be the best place for your physical and mental health and all areas of your life, of course.
Yeah, it's the best thing I did. Fantastic. I did that last year. Last year I stopped, and my fitness, my going to the gym, all of these things, everything just changed for me. And I was like, even the clarity in my mind, I was like, I cannot believe that this is the impact. Because I wasn't a massive, massive drinker, but just being able to understand like your relationship and understanding the impact that it has day to day on your energy levels, especially with ADHD, you're like, oh, this makes sense.
Totally. Kryptonite for ADHD. Yeah. Kryptonite.
Definitely. We ask everyone one question at the end of every single podcast episode, and it's something random. But it's the same question that we ask everyone. And that is, dun, 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 you ready? Do you feel life is fair?
Yeah. Sadly, I don't think it is. I think, you know, it'd be all very well for me to sit here in my Western world with power and food and water and everything at my beck and call and say that life is fair. I don't think it is. Maybe if we discover that either this is some kind of crazy experiment or illusion or matrix, or maybe we're on a journey of living many lives of becoming better and better and better. Maybe if we zoom out, we find that Newton's law is true, which is for every action, there's a reaction, that all things are equal. Maybe we do find that. But looking at the world today and how some people's lives and some people show up, no.
Thank you. I know I put you on the spot there, but honestly, I love asking that question because it's so interesting just to hear everyone's responses. But just thank you. I will share all your links to everything, and all the best.
Yeah, and same to you. Good luck with the book and keep smashing it. Keep doing the amazing work that you're doing. And thank you for helping me spread the word.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
Hey there. Are you ready to take your personal growth journey to the next level? I'm really excited to announce that my new online course is finally here. And in this course, we deep dive into topics we explore on this podcast, but with even more in-depth lessons, practical exercises, and personalized guidance. Don't miss out on this opportunity to invest in yourself and unlock your full potential. Enroll now and join me on this life-changing journey.